From WRKF in Baton Rouge and WWNO in New Orleans, you're listening to Louisiana Considered. I'm Karen Henderson. On the show today, Empty the Shelters is an upcoming event to encourage more people to adopt pets by reducing the costs. We'll learn more about how Louisianans can get involved at any of the state's six participating shelters. And Rosh Hashanah, the Jewish New Year, began last night at sundown. We look back on a conversation on Jewish history in the state and around the South. But first, all eyes will be on congressional midterms this fall. But reports indicate that State Senator Karen Carter-Peterson's abrupt departure from the legislature will set up an intriguing special election this fall that pits two well-known progressive politicians, Mandy Landry and Royce Duplessis, against each other. Capital Access reporter Paul Braun has this preview of the upcoming election.
Karen Carter-Peterson stunned Louisiana's political world last spring when she resigned her seat in the state Senate to focus on her mental health and her years-long struggle with gambling addiction. And there was more to the story. In August, she pleaded guilty to wire fraud for diverting nearly $100,000 in campaign funds to feed that addiction. The unexpected vacancy in Senate District 5 quickly drew two of the biggest names from New Orleans' Democratic Party, State Representatives Mandy Landry and Royce Duplessis. Jeremy Alford of Law Politics says that's not surprising.
I doubt there's many senators who don't envy what this district has to offer to the person who holds this seat.
It's home to the Superdome, Xavier University, the LSU Health Sciences Center, Tulane, and Loyola. And it runs down the river to pick up parts of Metairie and Jefferson Parish, too.
Which is a really dynamic district, and there's always a lot at stake in this one, and it always has a lot of big players in it.
And Duplessis and Landry are big players in the state's Democratic Party. Both are young, progressive Democrats. Duplessis is 39 and Landry is 44. Both are ardent supporters of abortion rights, criminal justice reform, and other progressive issues. But the candidates have their own strengths, styles, and approaches to governing. Duplessis, for example, has made a name for himself as a leader on criminal justice reform at the State House.
My approach has really been trying to be smarter about how we deal with the issue of criminal justice when a large percentage of men and women who are currently incarcerated will be released at some point. What resources are we putting in place when they return to our communities that we're not setting them up for failures?
Duplessis sponsored legislation to ease reentry and incentivize businesses to hire returning citizens. He also led the debate on limiting solitary confinement for juvenile offenders and expanding options for medical parole. For Mandy Landry, an attorney by trade, her key issue is reproductive rights. Before her time at the state capitol, she represented abortion clinics in court. And as a state lawmaker, Landry fought this year's expansion of the state's abortion trigger ban at every step of the legislative process. And since the U.S. Supreme Court's decision to overturn Roe v. Wade, Landry has garnered even more visibility as a leading advocate for abortion rights.
It's just really more important now than ever to have people in office who understand those issues and can educate others on them. And there's just never been an elected official like me in the state with my particular experience and expertise.
Silas Lee, a Democratic pollster in New Orleans, says with so little separating the candidates' voting records, the race may come down to style rather than substance.
Here you have basically two candidates that are very close, almost, I would say, identical in terms of issue positioning and ideology. I think it's going to come down to voters feeling energized by one more than the other. And this candidate can create a sense of identification with the voters and a comfort level with the voters.
And that question of identity looms large in this race. Karen Carter-Peterson, a Black woman, embodied those two important constituencies. And District 5 was drawn as a majority Black district in 2011, but it's been transformed by gentrification over the intervening decade. In this year's redistricting session, state lawmakers stretched the district's boundaries across the Mississippi River into Marrero to bump up its Black voting age population, a configuration that would likely benefit Duplessis, who is Black. But those boundaries won't be used until next year, when the candidates have to run again to seek a full term. Duplessis said voters should keep that in mind when they head to the polls in this fall's special election.
African Americans make up one-third of this state, and we heard a lot of talk and fight about the congressional districts, but Equally as important is fair representation in the state House and state Senate. And that is another important factor as we look at this race and we look at the candidates.
But Peterson was also the only woman in the state Senate who supported abortion rights. Her brash, no-holds-barred style has been missing from those debates in the Senate since she left. Jeremy Alford again.
Karen Carter Peterson was the kind of senator who, you know, would kind of stand her ground and wouldn't be afraid to kind of pull the pin on a hand grenade and kind of stand on it. And that's something I could see Mandy Landry doing.
Particularly during debates on reproductive rights.
I believe Royce DuPlessis fits kind of an archetype of a pragmatic politician that, you know, I've seen him a number of times walk across the aisle when he didn't have to and probably when he didn't need to.
The candidates embrace those characterizations.
I've never backed down on issues that I believe in, and I don't think that anybody should, but you have to be able to bring people along to get anything done.
I mean, it was a no-brainer when Karen resigned. I was like, we need one person in the Senate who is an expert and can talk about and educate people on what has become the pressing issue of the day.
Early voting for the November 8th election begins October 25th. In Baton Rouge, I'm Paul Braun.
Pet adoption fees will be reduced at 6 animal shelters in Louisiana during the first week of October as part of the Bissell Pet Foundation's Fall National Empty the Shelters event. From October 1st through the 8th, the Bissell Pet Foundation will sponsor reduced adoption fees so that shelters can charge $50 or less to take deserving pets from kennels to the couches of loving homes. The Empty the Shelters event will be hosted at 280-plus organizations in 42 states. Here to talk with us about the event and why the need is especially great this year are Bissell Marketing Specialist Brittany Schlachter and from one of the participating shelters, Alex Coogan, Director of Operations for the North Shore Humane Society in Covington. Thank you both for joining us.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for having me. This is exciting.
Brittany, we'll start with you. I know most people are familiar with the name Bissell for vacuum cleaners, cleaning products. This is a separate arm, the Bissell Pet Foundation. Can you tell us about it, its mission, how it's come to help more than 100,000 pets find homes?
Well, Kathy Bissell, our founder, created Bissell Pet Foundation because she loves pets and she wants to end pet homelessness. We started in 2011, but Empty the Shelters actually began in 2016. And yes, since then, we've helped more than 118,000 pets find loving homes. The foundation, obviously, our largest sponsor is Bissell, the vacuum company that you know and love, hopefully. We also accept donations from the everyday person to help shelters like Alex runs and make this event possible. And we also have a number of other programs aside from our Empty the Shelters, but we also do spay neuter, vaccinations, microchipping. So anything that we can do to help pets find homes and stay in their homes.
Well, we all know the last several years with the COVID pandemic have been challenging for most of us, been challenging physically, financially, emotionally. How have these challenges affected animal shelters and how can this event help, Brittany?
It is a very challenging time for shelters and rescues across the country. We are seeing a lot of people being faced with the challenging decision of not being able to keep their pets because they can't find rental opportunities where they can have pets, especially large dogs. So I'm sure Alex can speak to this, but we are seeing more dogs than ever in shelters, and there's also a need for cats. And just like every other industry right now, staffing is challenging. Staffing and resources are hard inside shelters. So as a foundation, we are working to provide help in any way we can. So with Empty the Shelters, we're reducing adoption fees to make sure those pets are finding homes.
Now, Alex, you recognize some of the challenges that Brittany's describing there. What's it been like at North Shore Humane Society out in Covington?
So honestly, at first, when COVID first hit, the kids were out of school and everybody had all this time. We were breaking every kind of record with our adoptions, right? So it was great. We got a bunch of homes. But now I have never seen so many returns, never seen so many surrender requests. So we are seeing way more people try to apply to surrender their pet or return their pet than actually adopt them. So it's a really, really tough time. So it's awesome that we have this program that kind of gives people the opportunity. Sometimes people get worried, you know, when you do low cost like this, does it attract the wrong people? No, it honestly just opens up that opportunity and shows them, wait, this is actually a perfect time to get a pet, and they actually come out. So they always reach out to us. They make sure we know about it and that we have access to it. But we've been participating since I got here about 4 years ago. And I actually hear a lot about Kathy Bissell because she's super active in this community. So there's been a lot of times that we've been watching a situation, you know, thinking about going to do a rescue. And sometimes before we can get there, you know, oh, Kathy Bissell came, you know, she flew them all out up north where they're looking for dogs. So she helps a lot more than just this Empty the Shelter program.
We're talking with Bissell Marketing Specialist Brittany Schlachter and North Shore Humane Society Director of Operations Alex Coogan about the Empty the Shelters event, the first week of October. It's hosted by the Bissell Pet Foundation, and during this time, pet adoption fees will be reduced. Now, Brittany, are all shelters eligible to participate in this event? And I imagine that the different shelters would have different processes for adoption.
Well, Empty the Shelters is an invite-only event, so we are very excited to be able to work with our partner network of more than 5,600 shelters across the country. And like you said earlier, we are in 42 states for this quarterly event, so it's four times a year. And we're actually in Alaska this month for the first time ever, which is so exciting. But yes, the eligibilities and the specifications for adoption are going to vary from shelter to shelter. Obviously, we want shelters to have phenomenal adoption applications and a process in place. And to echo what Alex said, you know, fees may be reduced, but that doesn't mean that animals are simply being given away. Alex is working hard to make sure that these pets find the perfect home. And this opportunity through Empty the Shelters is so great because people visit the shelter for the first time and get to see animals. And we hope that even if they go in not sure if they want to adopt, they leave with an animal that they couldn't imagine their life without.
Now, Alex, you mentioned you've been participating, the North Shore has been participating the whole time you've been there, the last 4 years. What's that been like? And tell us a little bit about how you're preparing for this year.
Yeah, that's definitely probably going to be one of the weeks that we broke our adoption goals is when we were participating in Empty the Shelter. So we're super excited. We're prepping foster bags for it. You know, we've got our number flipper ready so we can keep track of all that. We've got our banner, the Empty the Shelter banner that we take our photos on, you know, whenever they find their homes. So we're also setting up volunteers that can come out and help us give these tours. But something I'm going to do this year that I'm excited about is something called long-term lane. So as you know, long-termers, those are the ones sitting in the kennels for sometimes up to a year. We have some that have been here over a year. We're going to set up a special area, long-term lane, where we have anybody that's been there 6 months to a year or longer. And we're asking people to go ahead and take a look at these guys first before we finish the rest of the tour, just so they can get that visibility and maybe somebody will take a chance on them.
Brittany, since there are several hundred shelters participating around the country, what's the best way to find one near you and the details on how you can adopt?
Well, BisselPetFoundation.org, you can visit our Empty the Shelters page. We have an awesome map that actually shows all the shelters throughout the country. It has information about the pets available and a little bit of information about how you can learn more from the individual shelter and some pre-approval date information. So visit there. And I would say follow us on social media and follow your local shelters on social media so you can see the available pets and look for those Empty the Shelters adoption photos.
Bissell Marketing Specialist Brittany Schlachter and North Shore Humane Society Director of Operations Alex Coogan, thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you.
From WRKF in Baton Rouge and WWNO in New Orleans, you're listening to Louisiana Considered. I'm Karen Henderson. Last night at sunset marked the beginning of Rosh Hashanah, the Jewish New Year, and as people of the Jewish faith gather for services or simply just reflect on the past year, we wanted to look back at a discussion on the South's deep and dynamic Jewish history. Back in June, Louisiana Considered's Alana Schreiber spoke with Kenneth Hoffman, executive director of the Museum of the Southern Jewish Experience, just ahead of their grand opening celebration. Today, we give that conversation a second listen.
Back when the museum started in 1986, what was the mission behind it? And how has that mission grown and expanded over the years?
The museum started at a Jewish summer camp in Mississippi. Henry S. Jacobs Camp is a Jewish summer camp in Mississippi. I used to go to that camp when I was growing up. And the director of that camp, a fellow named Macy Hart, back in the 80s, was being contacted by folks from small towns across the South who were saying things like, we're the last Jewish family in town, or we're selling the synagogue building to the Baptist church, you know, because there's just hardly anyone left. Everyone's moved to the big city. What should we do with all of the stuff? All the Judaica, all the religious items, or even the non-religious items, things like my grandfather's dry goods store, you know, finally closed, and we have all this great old cash register or whatever. What should we do with it? So the camp decided to become a repository for this disappearing history, and they built a museum at the camp, and which was a great place for the summer campers to learn about their history, but it wasn't accessible to the general public. And so that's why eventually they closed the museum down in Mississippi and started looking for a new place for it.
Well, give us some more background information. I know this is very hard to summarize, but when did the American South see its biggest waves of Jewish migration? What did these early Southern Jewish communities look like? Where were they? And how did they relate to the non-Jewish communities surrounding them?
There have been Jews in the American South since before there was an American South. The first waves of people that came over were Sephardic Jews. These are Jews that could trace their ancestry to Spain and North Africa. And there's a rhyme that the listeners will know. In 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue, and Spain kicked out every Jew, because that was when Jews were forced to convert or leave Spain. And so descendants of those families, eventually many of them made it to the Caribbean and then up into the South, places like Charleston and Savannah and New Orleans. And then later, after the revolutions of 1848, in Europe, especially in Germany, then we start to get Ashkenazic Jews coming, Central European Jews coming to the United States. And even more so after 1881, when the Tsar in Russia is assassinated and a lot of anti-Semitism starts. Now, a majority of these Jews come over and they wind up going through New York in what would become Ellis Island. But there are countless stories of folks immigrating to the South. The South was, and somewhat is still, very agricultural. Farmers. Jews came over, oftentimes having not been allowed to own land in Europe for decades or centuries. So they had honed their merchant skills and their artisan skills. The farmers need the merchants. They need the stores to buy their supplies and their seed, and the merchants need customers. So a lot of these Jews started out as peddlers, going from farm to farm. And yeah, there was some culture shock there. You know, somebody coming down the road pulling a wagon, or with a horse in a wagon, or maybe just a pack on his back, maybe didn't speak English, maybe had very strange eating habits, wouldn't eat anything that the farmer's wife served because everything had pork in it. And so a lot of these early peddlers were called egg eaters by the Choctaw Indians who would see them walking through, because they would bring hard-boiled eggs with them when they were on the road, because they kept kosher, of course. So there was a natural draw between Jews and the South. And that also led to a unique American Jewish experience that was different than New York or Baltimore or Boston or Philadelphia.
Egg eaters, that is a new one. Well, tell us some of your favorite artifacts and exhibits featured in the museum.
My favorite artifact, and I've talked about this with other folks and in other places, is a quilt It's a crazy quilt, which means it's got all sorts of patches all over it. It was made in 1885 by the Jewish Ladies Sewing Circle in Canton, Mississippi, right outside of Jackson. And they made this quilt to raffle off to raise money for the synagogue there. So first of all, it's a beautiful piece of textile history. But even more importantly, it serves as a metaphor for people coming together, working, adding their talents and their time to create something that benefits the community, the larger community.
While the museum seems to mainly focus more on families and communities, who are some of the more prominent Southern Jewish figures that you celebrate?
We do mention Judah Turo, who was a very prominent businessman and philanthropist in New Orleans. We mention Judah P. Benjamin when we talk about Jews and the Civil War. We talk about Louis Brandeis, the first Jewish Supreme Court justice. We talk about Panina Moise, who was the first Jewish woman to publish a book in the United States. But we don't spend a lot of time on famous people. We mostly want to talk about everyday people and what the experience was like for the average person doing average things. And I think that also is what makes our museum very compelling to our visitors.
Of course, not all of these stories are exactly ones to be proud of. Can you tell us a bit more about some of those Southern Jewish figures like Judah P. Benjamin who were on the wrong side of history? And why do you think it's important to tell the stories of people we might prefer to forget?
Absolutely. So Judah P. Benjamin was a senator, Louisiana senator, before the Civil War when Louisiana seceded from the Union. He resigned from the Senate. He joins the Confederate government, first as Attorney General, then Secretary of War, and finally Secretary of State. He becomes known as the brains of the Confederacy. And in our exhibit about the Civil War, we talk about Jews who owned enslaved people. And we talk about Jews who fought for the Confederacy, because it's important to do that. It's important to study all of history. And so we explore those topics. Later on in our exhibits, we talk about the civil rights movement of the 1950s and 60s. There are some stories to celebrate there about Jewish and African-American alliances. And then there are some stories of Jewish segregationists or Jews more often who remain silent, who may very well have been in favor of civil rights, but because of their tentative existence in their Southern community, they didn't feel comfortable or safe enough in speaking out for civil rights. And that's important too, to see how people react to their own time. And there's stories on all sides. So yeah, we're very aware of telling a full story of the experiences of Southern Jews.
That was Louisiana Considered's managing producer, Alana Schreiber, speaking with executive director of the Museum of the Southern Jewish Experience, Kenneth Hoffman. From WRKF in Baton Rouge and WWNO in New Orleans, you've been listening to Louisiana Considered. I'm Karen Henderson. Thanks to our guest, Bissell Marketing Specialist Brittany Slachter, Director of Operations for the North Shore Humane Society in Covington, Alex Coogan, and Executive Director of the Museum of the Southern Jewish Experience, Kenneth Hoffman. Our managing producer is Alana Schreiber, our digital editor, Caitlin Omholtz. Our engineers are Garrett Pittman, Aubrey Procell, and Thomas Walsh. You can listen to Louisiana Considered Monday through Friday at noon and 7:30 p.m. It's available on Spotify, Google Play, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Major support for Louisiana Considered provided by Rouse's Markets, a Louisiana shopping experience, with additional support from Louisiana Farm Bureau Federation.